So we're talking about Tarskyon consequence, and we're now moving on to Etchemendy's objections to Tarskyon consequence. So we've just seen that Tarski's basic idea is that we give a kind of semantics by explaining how the truth values of formulae are determined according to the interpretations of their components. Right, so how, for example, the truth of Bill smokes depends on the interpretation of Bill, the interpretation of the predicate smokes. Then we consider various kinds of reinterpretations of those expressions in accord with their retaining the right kind of semantic value. So if you start with a singular term or name, then any reinterpretation will have to respect requirements on that. So names can say refer to objects, but can't refer to properties. Similarly for predicates, smokes can refer to the property of smoking, say, but can't be used to refer to an individual person. So we have all kinds of different reinterpretations made available by selecting different, for example, different members of our domain of objects to serve as the reference for our individual names or singular terms. And then we say that a conclusion is a formal or logical consequence of some premises, just in case all of the available interpretations, all ways of selecting values for our expressions from the domain we have, are such that it's not the case that on that interpretation the premise comes out true and the conclusion comes out false. Okay, that's it. That's the overarching account. As I've just said, Etchemendy, at the most basic level, thinks that this view is subject to fairly obvious objection. Okay? It involves a simple conceptual mistake, confusing the symptoms of logical consequence with their cause. You'll see there's a way in which Etchemendy's objection goes beyond this. So this suggests, right, that Tarski provides like the right kind of test for logical consequence, provides a way of keeping track of whether you've got cases of logical consequence by symptoms, right, in the way that you might keep track of whether someone has measles by keeping track of their symptoms. Might be a fairly decisive way of keeping track of whether someone has measles by looking to see whether they have the relevant pattern of spots, say. But that wouldn't, just characterising the symptoms wouldn't characterise the disease. To characterise the disease, you'd want to get at what was explaining the symptoms, what was making it so that the individual with measles has the symptoms. The idea from that perspective would be that perhaps Tarski tells us the right thing about the symptoms, about how to test for whether we have a case of consequence or not, but he doesn't get to the root cause, kind of underlying facts that make it so that we have a case of consequence or not. So that'd be one way of taking this very general form of objection. But in fact, Etchemendy, so we'll see, goes beyond that and thinks that ultimately Tarski's account doesn't really even give us the right results. Okay. But that's his short form way of presenting the objection. So really there are two fundamental kinds of objection that Etchemendy wants to run against Tarski. The first objection is to this effect, that Tarski's account fails to sustain critical features of the concept of logical consequence. Right, and the idea is that this can be seen by considering the inability of the account to cope with modal or epistemic aspects of our intuitive understanding of logical consequence. Okay, say more about that in a moment. And you can think of this as the intentional adequacy objection, where intentional with an S here means it has to do with the concept as opposed to the extension of the concept. It has to do with the way we're thinking of things when we think in terms of logical consequence. So it would be consistent, right, and this fits the idea of causes and symptoms, it would be consistent to think this, right, that Tarski fails to provide the right kind of analysis of the concept of consequence, be consistent to hold that, while at the same time allowing that he gets the extension of logical consequence, right? He sorts cases into the right piles, cases of genuine consequence and cases of non-consequence. That would be like, I don't know, suppose you managed to come up with an analysis of knowledge that got the extension right, that captured all the cases in which someone knows something and all the cases in which they don't know, mark that distinction perfectly in accord with ordinary judgment. One might nonetheless think that the account failed to capture our concept of knowledge because one thought it was just too messy and complicated, right? I mean, suppose there were just a finite number of cases where people know or fail to know, then one way of getting the extension right would be to list them. Okay, but we might think that wouldn't be a way of capturing the concept of knowledge. And similarly, first kind of objection is supposed to work a bit like that. Now note that a slightly different form of objection might be raised at this point against tasking. I think it's distinct from the objection that Etchemendy wants to raise, but I'm somewhat tempted to think that it figures in the way that Etchemendy's thinking about the issue, and it might figure in shaping his own objections. So one might think something like this: Tarski's account couldn't be right because ordinary folk, right, people who haven't done any philosophy and haven't done any logic, can think logically, and moreover can, at least to some extent, track cases of consequence without thinking in terms of models, interpretations and domains and the like. So I think we have a way of doing this that's pre-theoretical, okay? A way that's available before we learn all that Tarski wants to teach us. And that would suggest, right, that this can't be an account of our concept of logical consequence because it involves technicalities that go beyond anything that we have access to, right? So the suggestion might go. It'd be like trying to analyse someone's ordinary notion of knowledge by appeal to some technical notion of counterfactual sensitivity or something, right? That kind of analysis might get the extension of the concept right. Right, it might tell you which cases are cases of knowledge and which aren't. We might worry that it made appeal to technical notions that couldn't really figure in the ordinary folks' conception of knowledge. Similarly here. So that would seem like a plausible objection, might think, if the aim of a philosophical account in this area, so Tarski's or anyone else's, had to be something like sense-preserving conceptual analysis. Right, so you have to get right the way that ordinary folk are thinking about these notions in order to provide an adequate analysis. But I think there's no immediate reason to suppose that's the right aim or the only aim, and certainly no reason to suppose it's Tarski's aim in this area. Right? Though Tarski's sensitive to our pre-theoretical and intuitive judgments about cases, it's not clear that his main aim is to try and specify how you're already thinking about cases of consequence before you do any theory or any philosophy. But I think that's a distinct form of worry from the worry that Etchemendy actually wants to push. But it would be worth, I think, keeping that alternative form of objection in mind and checking from time to time whether we think Etchemendy's objection don't ultimately trade on some kind of appeal to that goal, right? The goal of giving conceptual analyses that fit ordinary folks' conceptions of things. Okay, so the first objection, the objection from intentional adequacy, the conceptual objection, is that when we think about cases of consequence, and we think about what the requirements are on having a case of consequence, and we think kind of pre-theoretically in some sense about those cases, we think they have certain properties. Okay? We think, for example, they have modal properties, and we think they have epistemic properties that are special. And then Etchemendy's worry is that when we compare those commitments we have when we think about cases of consequence, they don't square with what Tarski offers us by way of an analysis. So that's the first kind of objection. The second kind of objection Etchemendy presents as a way of kind of pressing the first kind of objection, a way of kind of revealing to us ways in which the Tarskian analysis fails of conceptual adequacy. So his idea is that the first failing, conceptual failing, is evidenced by extensional failings of the account, by its failure to properly capture all the genuine cases of consequence and rule out non-genuine cases. Crudely, Etchemendy thinks that insofar as Tarski's account is able to be extensionally adequate to get the selection of cases right, it does so only through appeal to extralogical assumptions. In particular, extralogical assumptions about the size of the universe, the size of the available domains. So this is what Etchemendy thinks of as the extensional adequacy objection. So the worry isn't quite that Tarski's account fails to put cases into the right piles, fails to put all of the cases of genuine consequence over here and the non-genuine cases over here. It's rather that it can do that, but it can only do that if it assumes things about the size of the universe. For example, assumes, say, that there are infinitely many objects in the universe. Okay, and then the idea will be that that assumption can't be part of logic, right? It can't be a logical truth that there are infinitely many objects. So if Tarski's account attains extensional adequacy only by building in this assumption that there are infinitely many objects, say, then it can't be providing a proper grounding for logic. Okay? Because logic ought to be able to work without making that kind of assumption about what there is. Right? That's the idea. Some earlier philosophers used to say logic ought to be free of any kind of ontological commitment. Right? Logic ought to work if there's nothing, or if there's, you know, infinitely many things. That's the idea. Okay, so here's Etchemendy developing the first kind of objection, kind of conceptual adequacy objection. He says the property of being logically valid, like being a genuine case of consequence, cannot simply consist in membership in a class of truth-preserving arguments, however that class may be specified. Right, so it's kind of assumption of Tarski's account, as we've seen, that we are to characterise cases of consequence by appeal to the membership in the class of truth-preserving arguments of all reinterpretations of the target argument. For if membership in such a class were all there were to cases of logical consequence, valid arguments would have none of the characteristics described above, e.g. none of the epistemic or modal characteristics commonly thought to be essential to the nature of consequence. Okay. So if Tarski's account were right, then logical consequence wouldn't fit the ordinary demands we make on cases of consequence. They would, for example, be epistemically impotent when it comes to justifying a conclusion. Any uncertainty about the conclusion of an argument whose premises we know to be true would translate directly into uncertainty about whether the argument's valid. Say more about that in a second. All we could ever conclude upon encountering an argument with true premises would be that either the conclusion is true or the argument's invalid. And that would be useless, you might think. For if its conclusion turned out to be false, the associated class would have a non-truth preserving instance. Right? This would be a counterexample to the claim that we had a case of Taskian formal consequence. So the argument would not be logically valid in that sense. Logical validity can't guarantee the truth of a conclusion if validity itself depends on that truth. Right? So unless the conclusion's true, the argument's not valid. So in order to figure out whether the argument's valid, you have to check whether the conclusion's true. But that means you can't use the validity of the argument to take you from knowledge of the premises to knowledge of the conclusion. Right? Because you can't tell whether the argument's valid until you've checked that this particular case is truth-preserving. So you've checked that the conclusion's true. Let's go through that a bit more slowly. So Etchmendy's first argument, first conceptual adequacy argument, is about knowledge or evidence or reasons. The argument goes like this. So premise one, suppose B is a logical consequence of A. Then it must, in general, be possible to use knowledge of that fact together with knowledge that A is true in order to acquire knowledge that B is true. Right, so if you've got a case of consequence, then it must be possible in principle to come to know that you have a case of consequence. Moreover, to come to know that consistently with knowing that the premises of the argument are true. And when you can do that, if you have a case of logical consequence, it ought to be possible to use those bits of knowledge to come to know the conclusion. Okay, that's the idea. That's supposed to be built in to our intuitive conception of the nature of logical consequence. Okay? Must be possible to exploit logic in this way to extend our knowledge. But that's only possible if it's possible to acquire knowledge that the premises are true and knowledge that some conclusion is a logical consequence of those premises in advance of acquiring knowledge that the consequence is true. Okay? Otherwise, you couldn't use this to generate knowledge. You'd have to find out that the premise was true independently. And according to Tarski's account, that's something one can't do. Because on Tarski's account, acquiring knowledge that B is a logical consequence of A involves, amongst other things, knowing that it's not the case that A is true and B is false. Well, that's one of the things one has to check in order to determine that this case meets the Tarskian condition. So the idea is something like this, that on the Tarski condition, to find out that you have a case of consequence, you have to check all the relevant cases. You have to check with respect to every reinterpretation of premises and conclusion that the premises aren't true while the conclusion's false. Okay? So run through all the cases. When you've done that, if there are no cases where the premises are true and the conclusion's false, it's a case of consequence. But in running through all those cases, one of the cases you have to check is the case you started with. And you know that the premise of that case is true. So in order to check whether you have a valid argument, you have to check that the conclusion's true. In doing that, you have to establish the truth of the conclusion, right, in advance of finding out that this is a case of logical consequence. So if you know that A is true, coming to know that B is a logical consequence of A amounts to coming to know that B is not false, that B is true. So you couldn't find this out and then use it to come to know B in the way that we, according to Etchemendy, ordinarily think we can make use of logic. Okay, so what should we say in response to this form of argument? Well, one thing to say, I think, is that it's not obvious that this objection shows that there's anything actually wrong with Tarski's account. Right, minimally, perhaps it shows only that the account needs to be supplemented with an account of how one can come to know that B is a logical consequence of A, independently of knowing the truth values of A and B. I mean, it's true that Tarski's account doesn't on its own give us an answer to that question. Right? So that's a question about how one can come to know things. But it's true in general, right, that accounts of the nature of things and accounts of facts don't in general provide answers to questions about how one can know those facts. Okay, so it might well be, consistently with Tarski's account tells you how the logical facts are, tells you under what conditions you will have a case of logical consequence, without adding in an account of how on earth we come to find out whether we have such cases. But we know in effect from Tarski's account that one way of trying to find out whether you have a case of consequence is to run through all of the cases, right, including the case you started with. So if that were the only way, consistently with Tarski's account, of finding out that one had a genuine case of consequence, by like going through the list, then we'd have a problem. But it's not clear that that's the situation we're in, right? The fact that Tarski doesn't write an account of knowledge of logical consequence into his account of consequence doesn't show anything either way. So providing such an account, providing an account of how one would know that one had a case of consequence, looks like a project for epistemology, rather than part of the project of giving a kind of metaphysical account of the nature of consequence. Like the essence of the consequence relation. In general, we think these are different kinds of projects. It's the project of saying how things are and the project of explaining how we come to know them. The fact that someone gives you an account, say, of the nature of some chemical element, say water, right, doesn't follow that they have to give you an account of how one knows about that. You might think that it would be good if providing such an account was possible, right? Nothing in the account of consequence or water ruled out the possibility of explaining how we know this stuff. But they're still different projects. Do you have a question? Yeah.
Call it a bit more something I was thinking about with Tarski's account.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of proving that a particular case is a case of logical consequence, mm-hmm. it seems to me that you would need to replace the name with every possible other name,
mm-hmm.
and that violates Tarski's own idea of compactness, because there are infinitely many names you can substitute in, and therefore you can't produce a proof that it's right or valid.
That's right if one were thinking of doing that in terms of a proof that went through all the cases in that way. I mean, there might be other ways of doing it, right? So, I mean, that would require that one had to have individual premises with respect to each of the cases rather than, for example, being able to generalise over the cases. But it might be a problem for the idea of proving in particular cases that one had a case meeting the Tarski conditions. But I don't think there need... I mean, this is connected with what I was just saying in a way, that there's no immediate requirement on Tarski to give an account of how it's possible to determine in any particular case that one has a case of consequence, right? So suppose the only method we could have would be that kind of proof, and then there were bound to be cases, let's suppose, where one couldn't give such a proof because it would violate compactness. That would show that there might be such cases that we couldn't keep track of by appeal to deduction, but it wouldn't show anything was wrong with Tarski's account unless we had independent reason to think that any account of consequence should be accessible in that way. Yeah? So it's connected with this in that, you know, what we're told by Tarski on the face of it is a story about what it takes for there to be a case of consequence. this separate matter to explain how we ever go about finding out whether or not we have such a case, at least on this view, right? Unless we have reason to think that we have to solve these two problems at the same time,
given the same account.
I mean, look, one might think, right, that even if this, for this reason, doesn't turn out to be a knockdown objection, right, as it stands, right, because it just shows that, you know, minimally, if we want an account of knowledge of cases of consequence, we're going to have to add something in. Nonetheless, we might want to use this as a point of comparison with competing accounts. Right, so suppose Etchemendy offers his own account of logical consequence, and moreover offers an account that has built into it a solution to this issue about how one can come to know whether one has a case of consequence. That might be a kind of gold star for Etchemendy's account, a black mark against Tarski's. Right? So there might be grounds for comparison, even if this objection isn't decisive.
One would need to look at Etchemendy's account to compare and contrast.
Now, if it could be shown that Tarski's account is incompatible with providing such an epistemology, perhaps we could turn that into a difficulty for the account. But again, it's not clear at all that Etchemendy's established a difficulty of principle. It seems to have pointed to a gap in Tarski's overall account rather than a problem. I mean, no, just going back to the issue about proof and compactness, again, we might think that, well, there are two ways of conceiving of Etchemendy's objection, kind of strong way and a weak way. The strong way says it must always be possible to establish that one has a case of consequence, to come to know one has a case of consequence in advance of knowing the truth of the conclusion, in particular in cases where one knows the truth of the premise. Right, so on that view, if one had any cases where one could show that one couldn't know that, that would be a problem. But it looks like that's a demand too far. Right? That would be a kind of immodest demand that we can know all of the logical facts. Right? Weaker demand would just be that there are some such cases. We think there are cases, right? We think we know of cases, we think we've been involved in cases where we can know that we have a case of consequence in advance of knowing the truth of the conclusion. Right, we do some proof or whatever, find out we have a case of consequence, and then we independently establish the truth of the premise and put ourselves in the position to come to no conclusion. Right, and Etchemendy's weaker requirement is that there must be some cases of that kind. And then his worry is that Tarski's account is incompatible with having any such cases. Okay. And one third comment on this epistemological issue, but I'm not going to attempt to solve the issue, but I don't think that's at all straightforward. But the issue in general, I think, isn't straightforward. Well, I don't think it's in general true that it's kind of obvious that whenever one has any kind of case of consequence, one can exploit it in the required way to extend one's knowledge. Just take something like this kind of line of argument. Got this is water, right? So I take myself to know that this is water. Okay, it's water in this bottle. Moreover, I know that water is partly constituted by oxygen. Okay, so it looks like I can use, this might not be a case of logical consequence, some kind of case of consequence. It looks like in some cases, on Etchemendy's view, I can move to acquiring knowledge that this is partly constituted by oxygen. We might think there could be cases like that, but there's absolutely no guarantee that I'm in such a case. Because I might know, I might kind of start by knowing or firmly believing these premises, realise that it follows from what I take myself to know, that I must be in a position to know that this is partly constituted by oxygen, and then worry that that's not something I can know. Right? I'm not in a position to know this is partly constituted by oxygen. but I haven't done any independent tests, that might lead me back to question whether I really know that this is water. Right? Yeah.
It would still be really odd to then doubt the whether the argument is valid.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's not the issue. The issue is just about the issue here is just about whether we should have a general expectation that where we have cases of logical inference, we can be in a position to know the premises, know that the argument's valid, and thereby come to know the conclusion. So I'm not worrying specifically about Etchemendy's concerns about known validity. Just thinking about the general structure doesn't seem to me to be obviously true, that even in cases where we know we have a case of something that looks valid, we're automatically in a position to exploit that knowledge to acquire knowledge of the conclusion. Sometimes seeing what follows and what we ought to be in a position to know from knowing that will throw into doubt our entitlement to the premises. But this is a kind of worry that some of you may have come across before in thinking about whether knowledge is closed under known entailment, right? Kind of thing that you worry about a bit in some first year philosophy classes and perhaps in epistemology later on. Right, whether whenever you know some premises and know that something follows from those premises, you're thereby automatically in a position to come to know the conclusion. It doesn't seem to me obviously correct that one can. So in this kind of case, this is water. Water's partly constituted by oxygen, so this is partly constituted by oxygen. We might think that the premises can furnish grounds for the conclusion, right, along with Etchemendy, but we might alternatively think that when you have this structure, any doubt about the conclusion is liable to transmit back up to doubt about one or more of the premises. So, needs a bit of care to make absolutely clear what the relevant epistemological properties are of valid arguments, right? Arguments one knows to be valid. Okay, so it's one central issue in epistemology, in effect, which direction of inference has priority in which circumstances. You've got this valid argument, known valid argument. Under what conditions does knowing that argument put you in a position to use worries about the conclusion to generate concerns about premises? And in which conditions does it put you in a position to use knowledge of the premises to generate knowledge of the conclusions? I don't think it's straightforward to answer those questions. We can't simply assume that Etchemendy's right. About how this figures in Tarski's account. Okay, that we can't always use this kind of transmission principle to generate new knowledge, or that we can. So I think the jury's kind of out about this kind of issue, this epistemological issue. There's a worry there, and there's a challenge for the defender of Tarski, which is to think about how one might go about explaining how we could come to know cases of consequence without running through all the examples, right, all the particular cases. It's not clear that can't be done. And it's not clear it's a general demand that it must be possible to do it. Okay, so that's the epistemological worry, the epistemic worry that Etchemendy has about Tarski's account, about conceptual adequacy of the account. The second argument, I think, is apt to seem more powerful, in part because people tend to have slightly stronger views about the relevant demands imposed on cases of consequence. So Etchemendy's second argument starts from what we've seen to be a fairly standard view about what it takes for there to be a case of consequence. So the idea is just that if B is a logical consequence of A, then it has to be impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false. Okay, it's a standard view of consequence in general, and it's a standard view of what it would take to have a case of logical consequence. So this is a kind of modal objection, right? So you know that Etchemendy said he had a modal objection, an epistemic objection. This is the modal objection because it appeals to the modal notion of impossibility. But Etchemendy tries to argue that all that follows from Tarski's account, and this is an effective thing I've been stressing, is that it's not actually the case that the premises are true and the conclusion false. And that it's not the case that there are any interpretations where the premise is true and the conclusion is false. So on the face of it, it's kind of a strong objection. On the one hand, we have what looks to be a fairly intuitive demand on cases of consequence, including cases of logical consequence. And on the other hand, it's far from clear that Tarski's account delivers the right result. Indeed, Etchemendy thinks it clearly doesn't deliver the right result. It gives you some other property instead. Instead of it's impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false, you get this pattern of properties, right? It's not the case the premise is true and the conclusion is false. And moreover, for all reinterpretations of premises and conclusion, there are no cases where premises are actually true and the conclusion actually false. Etchemendy continues. Although Etchemendy claims Tarski recognised, right, explicitly recognised the requirement that if you have a case of consequence, it's impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false. Although Tarski recognised that requirement, and moreover, everyone should, because it's obviously part of our conception of consequence, Tarski was mistaken in thinking that his account has the required output. Right? So Tarski agreed that any decent account should meet this condition, but thought that his account did meet the condition. But the reason he thought that his account met the condition was because he made a stupid error. Right, in reasoning to this conclusion, in reasoning from his account of consequence to the conclusion that his account meets the modal condition, he committed a modal fallacy. This particular instance of the modal fallacy, being known, according to Etchemendy, right, generates this name, Tarski's fallacy. Okay? In honour of the great man who committed this egregious fallacy. So, there's this demand. We should all accept the demand. Tarski accepted the demand. Tarski thought he could meet the demand. He thought that because he engaged in some terrible reasoning. Okay. But moreover, not only does Tarski's reasoning fail, but any other kind of reasoning would fail. There's no way of deriving the modal conclusion, the modal strength conclusion, the modal conception consequence from Tarski's account. Like, no way not involving some analogue of Tarski's fallacy. You know, so it wouldn't matter so much if Tarski had screwed up at this point. Right? Tarski claims his account captures this modal notion, provides a bad argument for that conclusion, but the conclusion's true anyway, right? And we can provide better arguments. But Etchemendy wants to claim that no argument will work. So what's the fallacy? So we have, right, this is the start of the argument we're attributing to Tarski, we have that an argument is Tarski valid, formally valid, logically valid in Tarski's sense, if no variation in the interpretation of non-logical constants will make the premises true and the conclusion false. it follows from that that it's impossible to have an argument that's tasky valid, but in which the premises are true and the conclusion's false. That follows. Yeah. Because what it takes for an argument to be tasky valid is that the premises aren't true and the conclusion false. So you can't have a case where you have an argument that's tasky valid and at the same time as true. But so I think you're skipping ahead to the thing that doesn't follow. Okay? So you can't have that combination. Therefore, and this is the fallacious move, therefore, if something is tasky valid, if you have an argument that's tasky valid, then it's impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false. Hey, is that the thing you're worried about, that last?
No, I just think that's the argument.
Okay, so the consequence there is just the assumed requirement that if A has as a logical consequence B, then it's impossible for A to be true and B false. That's what we're after. Everyone accepts that Tarski's account delivers the intervening premise, that it's impossible for an argument to be tasky valid and at the same time have true premises and a false conclusion. But to get from what everyone accepts to the required conclusion, we have to commit fairly obvious modal fallacy.
Okay, see how the fallacy goes.
Let the diamond mean it's possible that V be it's tasky valid, that got an argument A therefore B, and U be that A's true and B's false, then we're moving and making a fallacious inference from it's not possible for something to be tasky valid and to have true premise and false conclusion, right, which everyone accepts, to if something's tasky valid, then it's impossible for it to have a true premise and a false conclusion.
And the easiest way to see what's wrong with that move is just counterexamples from other cases. So,
so let V, instead of being about task, you let V be any contingent truth you like. For example, I'm wearing trousers. Okay? And U be it's contradictory. It's not the case that I'm wearing trousers. So it's not possible that I'm wearing trousers and I'm not wearing trousers, right? That looks plausible. But the fallacious move would be, therefore, if, as things turn out, I am wearing trousers, then it's not possible that I'm not wearing trousers, right? So the mere fact that I'm wearing trousers makes it a metaphysical impossibility or a logical impossibility for me not to wear trousers. Right, which is obviously fallacious. So I think it's plain at this point that first of all that this is a fallacy. That's not a way of supporting the required conclusion. So second, it seems to follow from that, that if this is the way that Tarski attempts to secure the required conclusion, then he commits Tarski's fallacy. Right? And the way that he has of supporting the conclusion doesn't work out. Fallacious. It doesn't yet follow that there's no other way of securing the conclusion. Right, there might well be other ways of securing a conclusion. I mean, it would be kind of weird, right? You might argue like this. You might say, look, Tarski's really smart. Tarski's a kind of logical genius, so if Tarski couldn't do it, then no one could do it, right? Tarski did the best he could do running through this argument. Because he failed, that's really strong evidence that no one else could succeed. Now, in general, that would be okay, but it would be weird in this context where at the same time you're accusing him of a fairly kind of dumb modal error, right? Error in modal reasoning.
So you'd need to do more work to show that there's no other way of getting the conclusion.
We'll have something to say in that direction as we proceed. We'll be considering some ways one might try of generating something like the required conclusion. But for now, we have the following questions. Okay, first, did Tarski commit Tarski's fallacy? Right? Is there reason to think that this is what Tarski got up to? Second, independently of that question, is there a way of deriving the required modal consequence, the required demand on genuine cases of consequence, without committing the egregious fallacy? But then there's a third question, which is also worth pondering, which is whether an adequate account must sustain such a derivation. Right? Because we might think that, you know, we've got a trade-off here. We've got Tarski's account of logical consequence, and we've got some kind of sense, pre-theoretic sense, that we want it to be the case that logical consequence meets this demand, that it's impossible for premises to be true and conclusions false. If it turns out you can't have both at the same time, we face a question, which is better? Okay? And it's not always true that our pre-theoretical views about things trump our best theories.
So we need to think carefully about whether we think Etchemendy's right to press this demand against Tarski. So to end by saying something brief about the first question. So
one thing to say here is that Tarski doesn't explicitly, as far as I've been able to establish, doesn't explicitly attempt the derivation that Etchemendy accuses him of attempting. But what all Tarski does is say that a proof of a similar looking claim is possible. Right? As far as I can tell, actually, I mean, there's a question about whether Tarski even commits to the claim that there's a derivation of the thing that Etchemendy wants. But at most, he commits to the existence of such a proof. He doesn't offer a proof himself, so he doesn't offer the Tarski fallacious proof.
There's no straight evidence that that's what he was thinking of.
Now, the similar-looking claim that Tarski does claim to be able to prove, to derive from on the basis of his account, involves use of the expression necessary. And Tarski makes use of similar-sounding, like, related forms of words. It must be the case that, it must be so that, those kinds of things. But I mean, in effect, as we saw when we started in thinking about Aristotle, it's never entirely clear, without more ado, how to understand talk of that kind. So perhaps those occurrences of talk of necessity and talk of what must be so can be read in a way that doesn't involve Tarski in claiming any kind of proof of the particular modal requirement that Etchemendy thinks he should be able to prove, that he should attempt to prove. Third point is that much of Etchemendy's criticism of Tarski is premised on the idea that Tarski was trying to reduce an unclear modal view of consequence, but unclear just because it makes appeal to this notion of necessity or impossibility, trying to reduce that unclear modal view of consequence to a clear material account, a clear account based just on actual patterns of truth values, together with interpretations. So the question here is why, if Tarski thought the modal view was so unclear that it needed to be kind of replaced by some other sort of account, why he'd have cared about capturing that unclear requirement in his own account. Right, I mean, if you thought that ordinary folks' judgments about subjectivity or something, the nature of the subjective, were just irredeemably confused and a mess, you wouldn't attempt in general to capture all of those judgments in your best philosophical account of the nature of subjectivity. Right? You'd be pleased if you shed some of those incoherent, unclear requirements. And one way of thinking, that looks to be what Tarski was up to here, trying to move away from various unclarities attending ordinary folks thinking about consequence in order to provide a sharp, clear, formalisable kind of account that could replace that ordinary notion. That connects up with the fourth point. So along with some other theorists in this period, people like Carnap, Tarski viewed modal talk as imprecise, indeed viewed a lot of ordinary talk on a lot of subjects as in various ways imprecise and confused, not suitable for use in serious formal work, for example. Right, so much of Tarski's work aims at something we could think of as elucidation or explication of informal notions. Well, this isn't an ordinary attempt to analyse those notions, to provide some kind of conceptual analysis. Rather, the aim is to provide absolutely sharp replacements for those informal notions in order that one can then do serious formal work with the replacement. Right? You can't do, say, formal work with anyone's ordinary notion of knowledge or truth, but you can perhaps replace those notions with some kind of surrogate sharply defined, and then do formal work on that basis. So this is one of the things that's going on, seems, in Tarski's work on truth. He thinks our ordinary conception of truth is incoherent. He thinks it can be replaced with something that's close to our ordinary notion and not subject to various kinds of incoherence. So if that's what Tarski was up to with respect to logical consequence, and it's natural to think he was, it would be mysterious why Tarski would claim to have proved the relevant modal claim without providing the right kind of analysis of the kind of possibility that proof would have to involve. Right? He would never try and prove anything about the ordinary notion of truth, right, without first replacing the ordinary notion with some sharply formulated surrogate. Doesn't seem to do that with respect to the required notion of possibility or necessity, so it would be odd to think he'd then try and generate a proof of anything to do with it. And final point, which I've already mentioned, is that it just doesn't take a genius to spot the particular fallacy that Etchmendi accuses Tarski of using. And moreover, it doesn't appear to require post-Tarskian sophistication about modality. I mean, we have become more sophisticated in our thinking about modality since Tarski wrote. But it's not clear that the sophistication we gain by thinking in terms of, for example, formal systems of possible worlds is required to see that this transition that Tarski's accused of making is invalid. So in that case, the question is whether it's really plausible to think that Tarski would have committed this particular error, right, in a serious piece of work. It's not to say he couldn't have done, but it's somewhat implausible, given how obvious the error is. Okay.